This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV nationwide and also listen to it on Pacifica stations. The New York Times reported that the U.S. war in Afghanistan has gone on for so long that it has now surpassed our own civil war in length. The longest war the U.S. has ever waged often gets short shrift in news reporting or political and public attention. Generals and elected officials have spelled the imminent end of the Afghanistan war numerous times, but an end is elusive, and ordinary Afghans continue to suffer. There are currently about 8,400 U.S. troops in Afghanistan, alongside a few thousand NATO troops. And General John W. Nicholson, who the U.S. general who leads coalition forces there, has asked the Trump administration for even more troops. Complicating the war are reports that the Taliban, the U.S.'s main enemy force, is now reaching out to the Russian government for help fighting the Islamic State, which has also established itself in the beleaguered Central Asian nation. My guest is Douglas Wissing. He's a journalist and author of Hopeless But Optimistic: Journeying Through America's Endless War in Afghanistan and Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. His work has also appeared in the Washington Post, the New York Times, the LA Times, and Foreign Policy. And he recently wrote an article in TheHill.com entitled, "Let's Admit the Obvious, Afghanistan War is Unwinnable." Welcome to the program, Douglas.
Thank you. It's good to be here again.
So as I said, this is a war that often gets short shrift, yet it is the first war that came out of the September 11th attacks. It is the war that continues with no end in sight. Why has the U.S. had trouble wrapping up this war in particular? This was almost a war that George W. Bush wasn't interested in getting into. His real target was Iraq. He went into Afghanistan, and now we're just there year after year after year.
Well, you're right. This is the forgotten war, though it is also by far our largest foreign military involvement. As you said, we have 8,400 soldiers, and what doesn't get added into that boots on the ground count are the special operations teams. There are thousands and thousands of special operations teams still in the country, as well as tens of thousands of highly paid defense contractors and contractors for other agencies. We're still spending, for fiscal year 2017, the State Department and the Defense Department are asking for about $50 billion, which is just kind of a number, unless you compare it to what they asked for the war against ISIS in Syria and Libya. That's only $5 billion. So $50 billion for Afghanistan, $5 billion for the fight against ISIS, yet everybody's paying attention to that particular war. So this is our 16th year. It's gone on and on and on, and there is no end in sight. The Pentagon is asking for more troops, and the big difficulty we have is that this is essentially a lost war. This is a failed war, and doing more isn't going to come up with a different outcome.
Now, the forces in Afghanistan are very complex. I mentioned the Taliban, but the U.S.'s first enemy there was really supposed to be Al-Qaeda. Then you had the paramilitary forces, or the sort of extremist militias that were the U.S.'s allies against the Soviets, the Northern Alliance that various factions have joined the government. Now you have the Islamic State. Has the U.S.'s own policies over the course of the war been partly to blame for why there's so much corruption in the government, there's so much violence in the countryside, and groups like the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and Islamic State flock to Afghanistan? Has the U.S., through its bungling, created, in part, this mess?
We certainly bear a lot of the blame for that. Afghanistan is ranked among the most corrupt governments on the planet. It has risen up the charts every year that we've been there. We essentially overwhelmed a minuscule economy with a grotesque amount of money, and we did ally ourselves with essentially some pretty malign actors, kleptocrats. They have become fattened on our money. And there is a toxic network that connects our ambitious American careerists the for-profit development and military-industrial complex companies, kleptocratic Afghan insiders, and the Taliban. It's one intelligence soldier told me, he said, it's the perfect war. Everybody is making money.
Everybody and except money, ordinary Afghans, of course.
Except for soldiers on the ground and everyday Afghans. Yeah. When we invaded Afghanistan, it was at the bottom of every human development indices. In the period since 2001, when we invaded, we have put more aid and development money into Afghanistan, about $117 billion and counting. That's more money adjusted for inflation than we spent on the Marshall Plan. Afghanistan is a country of about 30 million people that make on average somewhere around $400 a year. And at the end of 16 years, at the end of $117 billion, Afghanistan remains at the bottom of virtually every human development indices: literacy, life expectancy, electricity usage. The Afghans are victims of what's called phantom aid. The money was skimmed off by greedy corporations, by kleptocratic Afghans, by you name it, but very little of it got to the Afghans that really needed it.
And of course, the U.S. still doesn't acknowledge openly that this is what has happened, that the money has simply gone into the wrong hands. And the solution that General Nicholson is offering seems to be identical to what previous generals have done, what previous commanders and chief presidents have done, which is we just need a few more troops. If we can just get a few thousand more troops, we can better train the local forces to deal with their internal threats, and then we can leave, right? I mean, how is this any different from previous requests for troop surges? And why would it work this time when it didn't work previously?
It is pretty incredible that the general is asking for a few thousand more troops without indicating why 2,000 more troops would do something when 100,000 didn't. The Taliban has grown in strength by double digits every year since 2005. In spite of we got up to 100,000 troops, there were another 40,000 NATO troops there, and it continued to grow. The attacks continued to grow. The numbers of the insurgents continued to grow. So doing more of the same isn't going to fix it.
Now, the Taliban, there were news reports several years ago that the U.S. was attempting to engage in the secret, yet not so secret, talks with various Taliban leaders in various parts of the world, sometimes in Qatar and Pakistan, and that the only way forward was to sit down and have diplomatic negotiations with the Taliban. Whatever happened to that?
Well, the Taliban really don't need to negotiate. They're winning to begin with. And we were frantically trying to get the Taliban to engage with us to the point where we were searching for what we termed the moderate Taliban. And we finally came up with an individual that we brought up out of Pakistan. He was a very moderate man. He talked at length with our people in Kabul. We were sending, you know, convoys to get him. We were giving him money. And then, as it turned out, he was a complete fake. He was a fraud. He wasn't a Taliban leader at all. And the embassy was a little embarrassed by that one.
Wow. Well, no wonder we didn't read about that in the news. And, you know, ordinary Afghans who've lived under the Taliban might say there is no such thing as moderate Taliban. By definition, they are the opposite of moderate. What about the Islamic State now? The Islamic State is the U.S.'s new bogeyman in countries like Syria and northern Iraq. But it has surfaced in Afghanistan as well, which, you know, is a little out of the ordinary one might have imagined, except I suppose if you see the Islamic State emerging wherever the U.S. has waged wars, it's perfectly consistent. How strong is the Islamic State there? And could that serve as the new bogeyman for the U.S. to give General Nicholson more troops?
You have used exactly the right word. It's a very small presence in Afghanistan of ISIS. I've seen a CENTCOM briefing. It's somewhere between 700, maybe 1,200. Who knows? And you have to understand that there are many insurgent groups in Afghanistan. You have a totally ineffectual government that is egregiously corrupt. So there's not a lot of popular support. So there are up to 20 insurgent groups. And that particular ISIS group, which is most powerful in eastern Afghanistan, over by the Khyber Pass, that is an offshoot of the Taliban that sort of splintered off from the Taliban at one point and became somewhat informally allied with ISIS. And what is starting to the kind of muttered behind the curtains is that the Afghan government, they aren't stupid. They understand that we opened the bank in Syria against ISIS. So suddenly every little insurgent group, maybe every attack can be tagged as ISIS, and then it makes a bigger boogeyman, as you termed it.
Now, what do you make of these reports? And I'm not sure how credible they are, but there are reports that the Taliban is reaching out to the Russian government for help against the Islamic State. Is, you know, the Voice of America is one source that's putting this out there. Have you heard anything credible about this?
Well, the Russians have a concern about an insurgency starting up at a high level in the old Soviet republics adjacent to Afghanistan. They had a pretty difficult situation with a radical Islamic rebellion going back into the Tsarist days, then went into the early days of the Soviet period. So they do take it pretty seriously. They've, of course, had terrorist attacks in Russia.
And they had a 10-year-long occupation of Afghanistan during the days of the Soviet war.
Yeah. It did not work out well for them at all. So there, I see no indication that the Soviets or the Russians want to go back into Afghanistan. And they are seeing the writing on the wall where the U.S.-supported Afghanistan government is widely considered to be ineffectual and corrupt. So they need to maintain order in their southern tier. And the Taliban, you know, which has a lot of popular support at this point. It is a very conservative Islamic country. And the Taliban wouldn't be there if they didn't have popular support.
The Bloomberg is reporting that Russia is backing the Taliban's demand to withdraw foreign troops, for all U.S. and NATO troops to withdraw from Afghanistan. This shouldn't surprise us, given the clashes, if you will, the tensions between the U.S. and Russia. And there's a larger conversation around U.S.-Russia relations, of course, happening now. But for the, is part of the Taliban's popularity in Afghanistan stemming from the fact that it is now seen as the only bulwark against U.S. interventionism? I mean, the U.S. has been dropping drones. It's been conducting raids for years. Civilians have been dying at the hands of the U.S. alongside the hands of the Taliban.
You know, it's a very complicated tribal society. So we're really talking about the Taliban has its deep roots into the Pashtun tribal group, which is about half of the Afghans. And they would be considered something that is a repository to the corrupt Afghan government.
So at this point, does it seem that the main thing or the wisest thing the U.S. can do is cut its losses and leave Afghanistan?
I don't believe more of the same is going to have a different outcome. We've already run up a bill of about $1 trillion just on the Afghan war alone. It's running on towards $6 trillion for the two post 9/11 wars, both of which are failed wars. Throwing, you know, there's that great economics term, sunk cost bias. And, you know, the smart business people know you don't throw good money after bad. And I guess I'm taking some small solace in Donald Trump is a pragmatic businessman. I don't think doing more of the same is going to really change things. We're 16 years into a failed war with a failed system. Some people say we haven't had a 16-year war. We've had 16 one-year wars, as each new commander comes in with some new wrinkle on what we're going to do. I'm not even sure the new commanders are doing that. They're just sort of running the same playbook that has failed all this time.
Trump has proposed an increased military budget, but to continue the Afghanistan war and to send thousands more troops, would Congress have to approve of a new appropriations bill?
Sure, but I don't think the Republican Congress is going to flinch at much of that.
Right. But from Trump's perspective, an increase in the proposed increase in the military budget doesn't necessarily mean he's interested in extending the Afghanistan war. He has spoken about and actually acted on bombing Islamic State targets in Syria and Iraq. But as far as you can tell, is he ignoring Afghanistan like others have done?
It's very opaque right now what is happening inside the administration in terms of their plans for Afghanistan. We do have 300 Marines returning to Helmand. I was in my book, Hopeless But Optimistic, Journeying Through America's Endless War. I was in Helmand and watched the Marines pack up to go. They're now headed back. Their 300 Marines are headed back to Helmand because that province is under Taliban control, except for certain pockets. It's unclear about what's going to be happening. Donald Trump is perfectly, he's, you know, declared bankruptcy four times. He's perfectly capable of pulling the plug on a bad deal. Will that happen? I don't know. A lot of that big budget increase that he's seeking, a lot of it goes to pretty sexy weapons systems and aircraft carriers. I think that's more Trumpian than grungy wars in Afghanistan.
What do we owe ordinary Afghan people, Douglas? You know, this is a country that has a generation that has known nothing but war. Today, there are 16-year-olds in Afghanistan who were born at the time that the U.S. began this latest war. And as you said, the human indicators, the human development indicators have changed very, very little over 16 years. And child mortality, maternal mortality used to be among the highest in the world, literacy among women and children, the lowest in the world. What do we owe Afghans?
That's a great question. People talk about this as an investment. And, you know, the Afghans have been at war now 35 years. And they had 12,000 civilian casualties last year, tens of thousands of combatant casualties, including almost 1,000 children were killed in bombings and crossfires and whatnot. And the U.S. is again doing a lot more bombings beyond just drones. So I think we have to ask ourselves, do we owe the Afghans peace? Do we owe the Afghans an opportunity to run their own country again? They're great people. They've run their own country for a long time. It's a great culture that's full of beauty and poetry. Maybe what we owe the Afghans is some peace. We've been using their country as the devil's playground for a long time.
Of course, even simply leaving Afghanistan will do nothing about the corrupt government we've put in place, the military, the militia commanders that we've empowered, or the Taliban, who, as you point out in your book, we have funded. So they will be left at the mercy of those forces, but that's what they're suffering now on top of U.S. forces. It's certainly a very, very difficult situation. You mentioned the returning veterans from the Afghanistan war. What about U.S. Soldiers who've served in Afghanistan? Do they get enough? Do they get enough attention here in this country, particularly from conservatives and Republicans who are now in power and who often talk a good talk about supporting our troops?
Well, these post 9/11 wars have really ravaged the military, and we have to remember only about 1%, perhaps less than 1% of the U.S. population actually serves in the military. So going from the draft days of the Vietnam War era, where that pain was spread through the population, now it's concentrated in this small subset of the U.S. population. And that population has been hammered by these wars. We've got 370,000 soldiers with traumatic brain injuries. We have 700,000 soldiers who are veterans who have 30% or more disabilities. We had 1,600 amputees, many multiple amputees from these two wars. And the burden gets put on the military families to try and care for soldiers that have been wounded in body and mind and soul. It's a lot of concentrated pain, and to just let this run on with endless war, I think the American public needs to ask about that. Do we, you know, $50 billion for a failed war, do we have better uses for that money?
Well, Douglas, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and spending this time shedding light on this forgotten war. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
My guest is Douglas Wissing. He is the author of a couple of books about Afghanistan, Hopeless But Optimistic, Journeying Through America's Endless War in Afghanistan, and Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. His recent article in TheHill.com is entitled, Let's Admit the Obvious, Afghanistan War is Unwinnable. We'll post a link to that from our site later today. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.